Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls for this morning. We like to believe that all of the things that happen to us in our daily lives, the good things and the bad things, all have clear and obvious causes. However, our guest for this hour, writer and scientist Leonard Mlodinow, says that chance plays a much greater role in our daily lives than we realize. We'll be talking in this hour of Focus about how randomness rules our lives. It is the subject of his book. The title is The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. The book is published by Pantheon, and it's recently out. So you want to read it, you look for it in the bookstore or the library. Our guest got his doctorate in physics from the University of California, Berkeley. He was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute, and he now teaches about randomness to future scientists at Caltech. He's also written for television. He wrote for the TV series MacGyver and Star Trek The Next Generation, and is the author of a number of other books that have to do with science. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief just so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, the folks who are listening are welcome to call. Professor Mlodinow, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Just first, maybe I should ask you about the title of the book, The Drunkard's Walk. What does that come from?
Well, The Drunkard's Walk is a mathematical term. Another name for it, less colorful, is The Random Walk, and it describes a process in which something is moving and takes turns in random directions at different times. So kind of random process of random meandering.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose that Drunkard's Walk as the title of the book because I felt that for one reason or another, our paths through life in some abstract sense resemble a drunkard's walk due to unforeseen or uncontrollable circumstances that happen to us. So I thought it was a good metaphor for what I'm saying about our paths through life.
I would expect that a lot of folks would find the basic idea here pretty unsettling in that we do like to feel, maybe we don't always feel in control of our lives, but we do like to feel that ultimately we do have some control, and that while you cannot deny that there is luck going on, being in the right place at the right time. At the same time, though, this level of randomness, there's something about it that's kind of disturbing.
Well, I don't find it that way. I think it's eye-opening to realize that when you have success, that it's not just that you're the anointed person or that you're the greatest, but to have a little humility that circumstances and luck were involved. And when you have a failure to have the comfort to keep going, to know that even if you have a good chance or a fair chance or some chance of success, if you keep trying, then it can happen for you, and not to take failure to heart. And that's certainly a good lesson for anyone, for instance, in the creative fields, in writing and art and acting. But even in physics, you can have many failures and be brilliant and have great ideas. And theoretical physicists like to say that if 90% of your ideas don't work, then you're not creative enough.
Yeah.
But there's a positive message, too, that I want to emphasize, which is that if you view things this way and you see how things are working, you realize that what's really important is to be prepared to take your opportunities, and that psychologists are correct when they say that the most important character trait in someone's success is not talent, but it's persistence.
Yeah, I think that's something it certainly...
I think those are positive messages.
And as I take your point, and I think that if there's anything maybe you would come away with from this, it would be that it would be sort of two things. One is that don't ever forget that no one stays on top forever, and the other thing would be, and yes, you've got it. Whatever it is that you want to try to accomplish, you've got to keep at it, because generally speaking, persistence is rewarded.
Well, Thomas Watson, the pioneer at IBM, had a great saying, which was, "If you want to succeed, double your failure rate." And he certainly was a great success. So I think he knew what he was talking about.
And that, I suppose, too, that you don't have to, you cannot deny that innate talent and ability, and coupled with hard work, matters. And that still doesn't mean that two people that are otherwise equal are both going to have the same level of success, but that it also does explain why, if you look at people in various endeavors, and athletes and scientists and people who are in show business, that it does at least in part help to explain why people succeed. Partly it's because they're really good, but that also, I guess, there is, you can't ever forget the fact that, yeah, you could have two people that are both really good, and one may succeed and the other not.
That's right, and it's a very important point that I'm not saying that randomness is the only factor in life, but it's a factor that's much larger than people realize, and certainly hard work, talent, ability are all important factors. But if you want to take an example, for instance, if you look at, since you mentioned sports, if you look at the World Series, mm-hmm. If two teams are playing each other, since I grew up in Chicago and you're not far from there, mm-hmm. let's say the Cubs someday in my lifetime, maybe this year, maybe not, get into the World Series. Well, they've gotten in, but let's say they're the superior team. And let's say the Cardinals, not the Cardinals, I guess. Let's say the White Sox are
never
the other
team. Cardinals. Yeah,
yeah, I just remember growing up, they were our big rivals.
Exactly.
But let's say the Cubs are playing the White Sox, and let's say the Cubs have a 99% edge over the White Sox, which means in the long run they'll beat them 99% of the time because they're that much better. Then, of course, the outcome of the World Series is hardly in doubt. But it still doesn't mean that if you played in numerous universes, that every World Series you played, that the Cubs would always win. Occasionally, the White Sox would win because there are uncontrollable and luck factors in baseball. If that weren't true, every game would be identical. If you had the same pitcher, let's say, on both sides and the same lineup, if there were no uncontrollable factors, be they sun or your ability at that moment to control your arm as you're throwing or as you're swinging, every game would be very boring. Every game would come out exactly the same. It would be like what we call in physics Newtonian or classical mechanics. But real life is more like quantum mechanics, where there's an element of randomness. Now, if the talent is so overwhelming that it's 99% Cubs to 1% Sox, you might not even see that. You might see most of the time, the chances are very great that in a 7-game series that the Cubs would win. But in real life, what I'm saying is that the odds are not like that. The talent differentials are not overwhelming, or the advantage of your company over your competitor is not that overwhelming that you're certainly going to trounce them. So let's take a more realistic example. Let's say it's 55-45. So the Cubs have an edge over the Sox, but they're not head and shoulders above them, which is probably more realistic in the World Series and in other endeavors. In that case, if you play a 7-game series, the chances that the better team will come out the winner are only 40%, or only 60%. So there's a 40% chance that the lesser team will win a 7-game series. The same thing can be said if you look at companies in the Fortune 500, for instance, and suppose that every company in the Fortune 500 was identical, and they all had a 60% chance, let's say, of success in any given year, however that company or that industry defines success. In that case, only one third. If you look over 5 years, over a 5-year period, success in 3 out of 5 years would be 60%. That would match their underlying ability. But if you look over 5 years, only one third of the 500 companies would actually have exactly 3 good years. That means that two thirds of them will have success that doesn't reflect their underlying ability, and one tenth of those companies, 50 of those 500. Would have a streak of either 5 good or bad years, even though they're identical to the other companies in the Fortune 500 in having a 60% ability. So this is how our randomness and ability both come into play when we look at results. And the flip side of that is to say that if you're looking at results, if you're trying to judge a company or a team or an employee based on the track record, and you only have a sample of 5 years or 5 efforts that they did, that they performed, that's not really enough to judge someone. Our results do not reflect accurately our underlying abilities.
Yeah, that's
the World Series, for instance, if you want to have what we call statistical significance, which means you want to diminish the results of the lesser team winning to only 5% or 1 in 20. In the example that I gave where it's a 55-45 split, and you want to play a World Series, a best of X, and have the lesser team win less than 1 in 20 of those series, you know how many games you'd have to play?
I'm sure more than 7.
269. Which is why we don't make sports into a science.
Well, it's interesting. I quickly find myself getting lost when we talk about probability, but I guess I certainly do take away the point that about track record and your time frame and the idea that, yes, in the World Series and best of 7 games, it's not necessary that the best team will necessarily true, the best team will win. But I suppose the idea would be as if, say, if you take your example of the Sox and the Cubs, and if the Cubs truly are the better team, that if all season long just all they did was play each other, that ultimately the Cubs should win more games.
Right, they should. Now, but again, as I said, even if the Cubs played the Sox every game, the season is not long enough. You'd be in the 269-game season to have the chance that the Sox beat them anyway. Be less than 5%. So you'd have to have, if you have a bunch of parallel universes, there'd be one of 20 of those universes, even if you played 269 games, the Sox, the lesser team, would come in first. By the way, to the Sox fans out there, I don't mean to diminish you, or to the Cardinals fans, since you are kind of Southern Illinois.
So. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we do. Donna, in this part of the state, we
I
do
know,
have
I have
Cardinals,
to admit, those Cardinals have been historically much better than our Cubs. So.
Yeah, can't. Yeah, that's a record you can't exactly argue.
And it's been 100 years since the Cubs have won the World Series. So.
Oh well, this is another one of those cases where faith triumphs over reality, I guess.
Well, in sports, you know, thankfully we only play those 7-game series, and we can have our beliefs and not worry about what's really true, and we can say the best team wins. But in real life, if you're investing in a mutual fund or making business plans, it's really better to not take that lighthearted view and to think a little more carefully about your decisions.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Leonard Lodino. He has a PhD in physics from University of California, Berkeley. He teaches now at Caltech. He's also a writer, has written for television, and has written a number of books about science. His most recent book is The Drunkard's Walk, the subtitle How Randomness Rules Our Lives. It's published by Pantheon. We have a caller here to talk with. Others who are listening are certainly welcome to call in. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Someone here locally in Champaign-Urbana on line 1. Hello.
Hi. Can you discuss a so-called random walk down Wall Street? They say the share prices don't have memories, but there are people called technicians who study the charts and look for patterns and trends. The trend is your friend, and they look for momentum, and they talk of head and shoulders. It's the pattern in the chart, but it seems they'd be better off doing some elaborate number crunching. And second, can you talk about Lotto? Because it seems advertising increases. It says buy the lottery ticket when the prize is like $100 million. But it would seem that there'd be some evidence for having smaller prizes for a lot more people. Okay.
All right. Well, you talk about those things.
Sure. Well, okay. Wall Street could be a show in itself, and there are many books and written on the theory of Wall Street and whether or not it's a random walk or whether what kind of deviations there might be. Actually, it would be called a geometric random walk because it's the random walk would be in the percentage changes, not in the actual price. And you know, I don't want to get into that, and I'm not an economist, but I did look in the book at the results of prognosticators. So rather than tearing apart or examining the theory of whether Wall Street is stock prices moved by a random walk, I looked at the results of prognosticators on Wall Street Week, shows like that, and Barron's, and also at the results of mutual funds, which try to pick the proper portfolio and beat the market. And what you do when you look at that is you compare how they do, of course, not to some absolute measure, but to how other indices do, such as the other averages, the Dow Jones or the S&P 500. And what overwhelmingly I saw was that they have no ability whatsoever. There have been studies of one study was done of about 100 newsletters and found that they did not beat the market. In other words, beat the indices. Wall Street Week doesn't beat them. The Barron's people, all these experts who come on TV and make their pronouncements. If you actually were to buy the stocks that they talk about, you wouldn't make any money any more or less than you would if you just bought the indexes. So if I buy mutual funds, no, I buy index funds. And I have an interesting graph in my book where I looked at the top 800 mutual funds, and I ranked them from 1 to 800 on the horizontal axis. And on the vertical axis, I put their return that they achieved over a five-year period. And so what you found is on the left side, where number one fund was, it was pretty high, and it went down in a very kind of a smooth way, and then it was evened out and down at the 800. On the right hand side, it was then obviously much lower, and the shape had a nice smooth shape. And then I said, okay, obviously when you look in hindsight, this is one of the mistakes that people often make about randomness, because they look in hindsight and see a certain order, and then they assume that there's a real meaning behind that order. So what I said was, let's look at the next 5 years. And keep the same ranking from 1 to 800. And let's see if that nice smooth curve that starts in the upper left and goes down to the lower right has the same shape over the next 5 years, which would mean that there was some cause over those 5 years that persisted over the next 5 years. And on the other hand, if there was no cause and if it was random, what you would expect if you keep the same ranking and you graph their returns would be something that looked random, like random noise. So I looked at the next. So I looked at these 2 5-year periods, and the graphs are in the book, and it's striking. The second 5-year period really looks like random noise. It doesn't look anything like the nice smooth curve that you had earlier. And people tend, when they buy mutual funds, to look back and buy the ones, of course, that had a good history, assuming that they'll have a good future. And what this shows is that that's not true. And well. It takes a lot of guts, of course, to buy some from the lower end, and to say there or to pick them at random and say it doesn't matter. But the point here really is that they don't just these funds don't just do this for nothing. They charge you a fee for their efforts, and the lesson of this is that fee isn't worth paying. And if you just buy an index fund where they don't spend all the money on the so-called research and prognostication, and they just put a balanced fund together according to the indices or whatever index they choose, you'll pay a lot less in fees and you'll make the same return.
At the same time, I guess that you might find maybe again here we're not being realistic at assessing their track record, but that you find someone, say it's somebody like Warren Buffett, who just seems to be in terms of picking winners a total genius.
I mean, well, let me say a couple things. First of all, I am not saying that, of course, it's impossible to pick a winner. Hmm. For instance, on the one end, in physics, we'll always start with the extremes to examine an idea. And at one end, you have inside information. Okay, mm-hmm. You have inside information that I make a widget, and my factory is about to blow up. Well, of course, that information is real. And can be used to make money by selling or by buying, you know, shares of the company, because you know something that other people don't know. So that's the one extreme. Now, that of course is illegal to use that information. So what people try to do is they try to get as close to that as possible by putting a lot of effort into examining the industries or the companies. And the problem with that is that system is so complex, and that the information about them comes out so quickly these days into the you know, to be general knowledge, that to actually get the information and be able to use it doesn't seem to be something that is practical. You end up paying more in your research costs, and these people are very highly paid, and in digging out the information that you're actually going to get by using it. And plus, that itself might not even be true if it wasn't for also the fact of random factors, that the president might announce something that, you know, the weather could change, that your competitor announces something. Just as in baseball, there's a lot of random factors that come in that even dampen out the effect of this inside information that you can dig out. So in the end, people argue about whether you can get a tiny advantage or no advantage, but a lot of people feel that the advantage you get isn't worth the money you put in. And when I looked at the actual results, that seemed to bear that out, that they were not doing better than the market. Now, that doesn't mean that individuals won't appear to have tremendous track records. And I didn't talk about Warren Buffett, but I did talk about a fellow named Bill Miller. Bill Miller seemed to be a genius and was written about extensively in the last few years because he runs a mutual fund called the Legg Mason Fund, and for 15 years in a row, his fund beat the Standard & Poor's Index. And so people say, Leonard, how can you say these things? And look at this guy. Isn't he a genius? And the articles called him a genius, and his fund was very popular. And it did seem that to people on the outside that he really must know something that other people don't know. But what I did was, as a scientist, the way you approach such a question, if you want to know, does he know something that other people don't know, you don't just look at his results. You compare his results to what you would see if everything happened by chance. In other words, to the alternative hypothesis that he doesn't know anything, or I'm not that he doesn't know anything, but doesn't know anything more than anybody else. And that's a tricky thing in randomness. So some of these articles, they actually did that, and they said, well, the chances of doing that by chance are 1 in 100,000, 1 in a million, one place said 1 in a billion, and they all got it all wrong because they didn't ask the right question. So here's the thing. If you started in 1990, I think that's when he started, and you have 15 years in a row starting in 1990, and you picked out Bill Miller specifically and said, what are the chances that he will beat the Standard & Poor's every year if he's just flipping coins to do it, then indeed the chances wouldn't be as low as they said, but they would be about 1 in 30,000. But that's not the right question to ask because it doesn't matter that he started in 1990. He could have started in 1991 or 1985. So when you say what are the chances that he will break the record, you have to take into account that people have more than one chance to do the 15-year streak. Also, there are 5 or 6,000 mutual fund managers. So it's not really fair when you're saying, did this happen by chance, to pick out one guy and say, what are the chances this person would have done it? You have to say, what are the chances that starting in 1990, some one of them would have done it, okay, or at least one of them would have done it? Because whoever that is, you're going to anoint the genius, and you're going to look back and say, wow, this person's a genius. So, but you would be wrong, because if you had enough coin flippers, one of them would do it. So what I did was I said, let's not assume that the person starts in 1990. They would have made as many headlines if they started in 1991. Let's look over the last 40 years, because one of these articles mentioned 40 years as the period of modern funds. And even though it sounds like a long period, it doesn't even hold three of these streaks back-to-back, so it's really not that long. And I said, let's assume there's 1,000 managers, even though there's more like 5,000, but I wanted to underestimate so that I would have a conservative answer. And I said, suppose that they get 15 or more years, wins in a row. What are the chances of someone in the last 40 years, if 1,000 of them are trying, and all they're doing is flipping coins, what are the odds that at least one of them would get a streak of 15 or more years in a row? When you put all those factors in that you have to really put in when you're looking at at chance, you found that the chances were about two-thirds that someone would achieve this feat. Now, and of course, looking backwards, whoever does achieve that feat, you're going to anoint as a genius. You're going to pick them out. You're going to pick out those years, and you're going to think it couldn't be chance. But when so many people over so many years are trying it, the chances are very great that someone's going to do it. So I don't find his streak very impressive. I think that, you know, the headline shouldn't say Bill Miller, the genius, achieves his 15th year of victory. I think it should have said Bill Miller achieves his 15, you know, the 15-year streak that has been expected finally occurs. Bill Miller, lucky beneficiary. And, you know, there's an epilogue to this story because this streak ended in, I think, 2005 or 6, and then he's had a couple of really bad years. Well, of course, that's, you know, if you're a genius, you probably don't oscillate good, bad years like that. But if it was luck, then every year, you know, you have no reason to believe the next year is going to be great. And, of course, people now thinking that he lost it, they're leaving the fund. And this happens everywhere. I mean, I also talk about Sherry Lansing in Hollywood, who had a great streak running Paramount Pictures, and there's a lot of economic studies that show that you can't really pick hits in Hollywood. And I'm not even talking about picking hits just before their release to say, is Batman, is the new Batman movie going to be a hit? I'm talking about years earlier when you give the, when you greenlight all that money for the movie. Can you pick which movies are going to do well? Well, there's a lot of studies that show that, no, that's just as random as Wall Street, and you really can't. You have almost no ability at all, and there's so many things that come into play. Is the actor still going to be popular? What else is going to be released on the same time? What's the political or the entertainment climate like? There are, you know, is the movie going to come out good? Is it going to be the right chemistry? Is the script going to go, you know, going to, well, probably they have some sort of script, but, you know, how is that going to go? And all these things come into play and give you very little ability to pick hits. And yet, in Hollywood, the heads of these companies are not chosen by their management abilities. Sometimes I think it's the opposite, but they're chosen on some imagined ability to pick hits. So Sherry Lansing was one of these beneficiaries because she had had several good years in a row, and she was considered a genius. And like Bill Miller, overnight people changed their mind when her market share went down from double digits to, I think it was 6-7%, and that lasted for a few years. They said that she lost her touch and she no longer knew what the public wanted, and they started criticizing her for okaying this movie and that movie, which to me, as I talk about in the book, it's hard to tell. You know, she's criticized for Tomb Raiders 2, but Tomb Raiders 1 apparently, you know, was a good choice just because it made money, you know. And if you look at it, it was all ridiculous. And a much simpler explanation, easier explanation, is that her luck changed. And, again, there's an epilogue because in Hollywood, because of the lag time, the long lead time in a movie, when you fire the executive, the next year, their movies are still coming out, right? It's not like the new person comes in and suddenly there's a new slate of movies. And guess what? The year after she was fired, Paramount had a big rebound. And in Variety magazine, it said something like, Lansing's legacy pictures, bounce back, you know. Well, if she had stayed in, her career would have bounced back, but they didn't have the patience to keep her in.
Yeah, well, at least, I don't know, did the next guy, at least they didn't give the next person the credit.
I don't know. I don't know. People, you know, on one level, they certainly don't give him credit when it happens, but I'm sure years later when they look back and they go look at his, you know, how he's been doing, I'm sure that those stats of his first year don't have an asterisk, you know. And Hollywood, I have to say, having written for Hollywood for a while, everything is image, and people are very good at manipulating it. So I'm not so sure, but certainly you could find the when it happened, the articles that recognized that they weren't his pictures. Yeah. Mm.
Well, this and this real quick, and I got some other callers here, but this brings me back to the idea. I said if there was one thing that I come away with, this is what in more technical terms maybe is regression toward the mean. But that gets me back to my idea that always keep in mind nobody stays on top forever.
That's right. That's right. Oh, and before you go back, the other question, I'll just briefly about the lotto.
Oh, sure.
I have an interesting statistic in the book, which is, I say this, would you play a game where most people don't win or most people just lose a very small amount? There's a couple very rare people who win a great amount, and there's about twice as many of those people who lose their lives. The kind of Russian roulette. Would you play that game?
No.
Probably not, but people do. That's what I call the lotto, because if you look at the statistics, you'll find that more people are killed in a car accident on their way to buying a lottery ticket than actually win the grand prize. So keep that in mind next time you drive. Wow. Drive over for a ticket.
I also think about it. It says maybe something about how bad people are not very good at figuring odds, because particularly I would think people who don't play very much, what gets them to play? Well, it's the huge prize. But then you're also the odds get longer because there are more players, where it would sort of make more sense if you could identify that game where maybe the prize was smaller. Maybe it was only $1,000 or $500 or $250, but there were fewer people playing, so your odds of winning were actually better.
Right. If there's fewer people playing, your odds. Of course, the state wants more people playing, and the state knows that people tend to underestimate the smallness of their odds when it gets very small. So to most people, whether their odds are 1 in 10 million or 1 in 100 million, doesn't have a big psychological effect on them. It may have an effect if the odds are 1 in 2. They may say that's a better game. But when it gets that small, they can make the odds virtually zero, and people will still play. What they look at instead, psychologists have studied this, They don't look at the small odds. They look at the big prize, and that's what influences their decision. And what the caller asked, I mean, if you took the same prize and divided it up to be 100 prizes, each 100th as big, your expectation in physics, in math, we would call it your expectation of winning would be the same. Your odds would be higher, your prize would be lower, and on the average, everyone would win the same. Or not everyone, but the average person would win the same amount. But because of these psychological factors, the state knows that that's not a good way for them. They want to entice people into, in a sense, acting against their best interest and give them the hope of becoming so fabulously wealthy that they like the large prizes.
Yeah. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have some other callers we'll get right to. Let me again introduce our guest, Leonard Lodino. He received his doctorate in physics from University of California, Berkeley. He was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute, now teaches at Caltech. He's also written for television for the series MacGyver and Star Trek The Next Generation. He's written a number of books about science. His most recent is the one we're talking about here this morning, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, published by Pantheon. By the way, if you go looking for the book, his last name is spelled MLODINOW, or you just look for The Drunkard's Walk. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here in Champaign. First, line one. Hello.
Yeah. Is this what insurance underwriting is based on? It's probability, right?
Right.
So it's basically sort of the same idea, isn't it?
Well, probability and statistics and random processes are each huge field. So, yes, but it's definitely based on that. And they in insurance, they use heavily theories called Bayes' theory, or they're looking at trying to infer based on what's happened in the past to infer how the probabilities are changing.
And they also, isn't it, there's that longer history of it, too, which plays in terms of, is the accuracy pretty good, or is it depends on what they're trying to predict, you know, in terms of the insurance?
Well, with the large numbers, they can't predict whether you're going to have an accident, but they're pretty good at predicting whether a large number of people like you or in your geographical area and your age group and gender and, you know, with your drinking habits or whatever they know about you. That's how they make their money.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I had a thought when you were sort of talking about the theory. Thank you. Good program.
Thank you.
All right, to line number two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is kind of a philosophical question, but regarding the nature of chance, is chance an integral part of the real world, or is it because of ignorance?
That's a good question.
Let me give you an example. Suppose I flip a coin 10 times and I come up with a certain pattern. Now, after the fact, if I were to duplicate those preconditions exactly, I'd come up with the same pattern. So it's, in that sense, it's deterministic.
Right. So
before the fact, I can't predict it.
Right. So in actual world, I could write a whole book just on this question. But if you're going to flip a coin exactly the same way, you'll get exactly the same result. So in some ways, certainly in our lives, usually the reason something we call something random or uncertain is because of a lack of control or a lack of knowledge. So it's contextual. When you flip a coin in actuality, it's random. If it's a fair coin, it's random because you can't control things, although there are people who claim that they can. And there has been at least one place where I think I was giving a talk at Microsoft, and they told me about someone had built a machine that flips coins, and it gets the same result every time, you know. The fact that randomness is a description of the outcomes, it means that we cannot say what the outcome will be. And if you change your ability to control the environment, you can change that. But in the real world, just like with coin flipping, you can't do that. So you have to go by probabilities. Now, they might not be 50-50. If a coin has great ability and studied hard about how to land on heads, it might land on heads 60-40 or 70-30. But in most of life, the odds are somewhere around that, and that certainly doesn't guarantee that result. And, you know, again, you have to remember, if the odds of the coin landing on heads are, let's say, 50-50, it doesn't mean if you flip it 10 times you're going to get 5 and 5. Chances are that you won't get 5 and 5. What the law of large numbers, which describes this, says is that if you were to flip it a zillion times, then the more you flip it, the greater the chances of getting close, very close to 50-50. But in small numbers, you can't even count on that. And one other thing I wanted to say was that that's the everyday world. Now, if you want to know the scientific answer, there is, that's the world of the large, Newton's world, the classical physics world behaves like that. And it's really can all, if you know all the conditions and all the laws, you can predict exactly what's going to happen. In modern physics, we know that on the atomic level and beneath that, quantum mechanics is what's at play.
Yeah, okay.
And quantum mechanics says that that's not true. You can know everything that you know, you can know all the laws and all the conditions, and there's still an unavoidable element of randomness, and you cannot predict. You can only predict the probabilities of outcomes.
Yeah, matter of fact, that's what led me to that idea that knowing that quantum mechanics takes probabilities at that level as part of the real world.
Right, and I talk in Drunkard's Walk about, I have a discussion with a mathematician from Israel who's very religious, and he had a hard time accepting that there is randomness in the world, and we were talking about dice.
Like Einstein's God doesn't play dice.
Dice, exactly, and we were talking about dice, and he was saying, you think if you throw a dice, a die can never be exactly 1/6 on every side, and he said that's because humans are imperfect, and I tell a story in the book about a guy who went to a casino and watched the roulette wheels and over some time with some cohorts took notes, found the statistical imperfections, went back and bet on them and made a lot of money. And he's right. You cannot make a perfect roulette wheel or a perfect die, but God or whoever made the universe, and it need not be anybody, I'm not taking a stand here, did seem to create it in a way that there is perfection of randomness in underlying everything, which is that there are processes that are equivalent to a die. Let's say they could have 6 possible outcomes, each of them being exactly equally probable. Or if coin, there are quantum coins that are exactly 50-50 one way or the other, and you cannot ever find any way to tell which way it's going to really turn up, and that seems to be the way that nature works.
And just one quick point also. You were talking about failure earlier, and one of my valuable lessons as a graduate student is I was running some experiments, and I went to my advisor, who was the principal investigator of these things, and I told him, I said, nothing is coming out the way we've predicted. And he looked at me and he said, good, now we'll learn something. That was the most valuable lesson I received as a graduate student. Thanks a lot. I'll hang up.
All right.
Oh, thank you.
Other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Leonard Mlodinow, author of the book, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. I think one of the points that you make here is that the human brain is a pattern-seeking device. And some people have, in fact, argued that that's one of the reasons that our species actually survived. It worked well for us. The problem is that maybe sometimes it leads you to see patterns, see connections between things where truly there are none. So how does one, given that that seems to be our natural inclination, how do you buffer that? Or is it possible to buffer that so that makes decision-making maybe a little bit better?
Well, what you have to do is be aware that your mind works that way and take that into account in your decisions, yes. There's a very stark experiment, good illustration of how people do this in a game called probability matching, where the subject views red and green lights that flash without any pattern except that the green lights, let's say, flash 3/4 of the time, and the red lights only 1/4 of the time. And if you put a rat in front of such a thing, of course you have to make it a rat experiment and reward the rat with whatever different rewards than most people seek. But
yeah.
But the rat will observe this for a while, and in order to get the reward, they will notice that green is more frequent than red, and they will just go for green every time. People, on the other hand, if you show them for a while, you don't really tell them what the experiment is. You just show them the lights, and then you say, okay, you're going to get a reward or points every time you guess right, so start guessing now. They'll have noticed that the greens are, let's say, about three-quarters of the time. And instead of just picking green every time, they'll try and people tend to guess green, red, in some path, you know, whatever, according to their choice, and they will guess greens about 75% of the time, and they'll guess red one quarter of the time, and they'll try and get which is which. Now, when you do that, you don't do as well as the rat. So the humans are outperformed by the rat, and the reason they're outperformed by the rat is that human brain has evolved in a way to seek patterns and to think that you can control the patterns. And people just instinctively they do this when they're trying to win. And when you're making business decisions or personal decisions, you don't want to do that. You're better in this case to be like the rat. So,
and pick green
by the way, interestingly, they've done the same experiment on split brain people, where the right and the left brain have been separated and don't communicate.
Uh-huh.
And one side of the brain will choose the guessing, and the other side will act like the rat. So even in your own brain, there's a little bit of a conflict about which way to approach it.
Hmm. Let's talk with some other callers. Champagne next, line two. Hello. Call there, line two in Champaign. Okay, how about line one in Urbana? Hello.
Hi, yes. I was just kind of wondering, how would you discern if someone actually does have a skill? Let's say someone does develop a skill to actually flip a coin and make it come out the way he wants. And so
That's called statistics. So probability is a description of the chance that something will happen, and when you don't know what those chances are, but you're just looking at the results, then that's called statistics to try to infer what the probabilities were. So that could be a longer discussion, which I talk about in the book. But the example that I gave of the World Series is a good example. If you observe the World Series 269 games or more, then you can make inferences about which was at least the better team.
Yeah, but isn't that the rub, is that we never have enough trials to actually figure that out?
Never know for sure, that's right.
Or not.
You can't, unless it's 100% one way or 0%, you can never know for sure. Or even if it was 100% of flipping the coin, let's say that was comes out heads every time, you can never say for sure that it won't come out heads the next time unless you have theoretical knowledge of it.
But
statistically speaking, if the coin... Even a fair coin that's 50-50 has some chance in some alternate universe will have a streak of 269. That may have to look at a lot of universes before you find that one. But, you know, so that's right. So there are statistical methods that tell you what confidence you should have if you're looking at a coin to decide whether it's 50-50, just like the fellow I described who looked at the roulette wheel. He said, well, these numbers are coming up more. He couldn't say for sure that these numbers are biased, or in other words, that the future they'll keep coming up more. It could have just been a statistical fluctuation that they came up more, and now he's going to bet on them, and he's going to lose. So you have to have some understanding of how you analyze that kind of data, and then you'll get what you end up with. It. The output of that analysis is, let's say, a range of the coin is between 50, fair enough to within, you know, X percent. It's 50.5, somewhere between 50.5 to 49.5, and I have a 95% confidence that that's true. You can never pin it down to exactly 50 and 100% confidence just by observing it.
Yeah, it just seems like we're kind of labeling it whatever way we want. We can either, you know, is like you never.
Well, but I mean, you can mathematically, you know, that's why they've developed these methods where you tell the I'll tell you that I'm 95% of the alternate universes, I'm right that the coin is somewhere between 50.5 and 49.5 heads.
But then we try to apply it to things like the stock market, in which you're never going to have enough trials to determine if there's skill there or if it was luck.
That's right. I mean, if you're looking at CEOs, don't look. See, if I when I for a while
think about
executive and I have people coming and interviewing, I have to decide whether to hire or fire them, or hire them or not hire them. And people make the mistake of looking at a small number of a short track record. I mean, I would look more at who is the person, what do they really know, how do they respond to me, what's their philosophy, what's their education. Look at really theoretical knowledge about them, and don't look at statistics, because those statistics, if you have five wins or five at bats, you can't just imagine telling. If you don't know a ball player, you don't know the person's name, and you get the guy or the guy went 2 for 5. Is that a 400 hitter? Is that going to person going to tear up the league? I mean, or you know, a lot of 200 hitters go 2 for 5 sometimes, right? You just can't tell, and that's the lesson there.
Well, if you, I don't know if this is too openly hypothetical, but if you look at some kind of endeavor where there is a very high level of risk in that the person is making a decision, say maybe the easiest would be gambling, where you're going to make a bet and the chances are high of losing. If you look at somebody who is a very successful gambler, is there something that person knows about calculating the odds that the rest of us don't?
Well, there can be. I mean, I'm not saying that if you can do card counting, that you can't do well at Vegas at blackjack. If you know, nowadays they correct for the roulette wheels, so you can't quite use that trick. But if you know that the roulette wheels was weighted, there is information that you can possibly have that could weight things your way. But most of the time, people walking out of the casinos with a smile on their face were just lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's plenty who don't smile, but then maybe they hide it a little more. But in the long run, we know that the casinos beat down more people than make happy, because otherwise, look how much. I mean, just go into a casino and look around you and look how much money they have. That money came from you, right?
Yeah,
it came from you losing. So yeah, there's people who win, but there's more who lose. But
yeah.
People, let me just, I know there's not much time left, but let me just tell you, people have a tendency to feel that they can control things. And there was a great study done at Yale University where they had students come in and try to guess the results of coin flips, 30 coin flips. Now, unbeknownst to them, the results were, they were lied to. They were told the results, each of them, in the same order. So they each saw the same sequence, had this experience, the same sequence of successes and failures, and they each had 15 successes and 15 failures. After they tried that, they were given some questions to answer, which were designed to ferret out their true feelings about whether they could see the future or control the coins. And you couldn't just ask them directly, because then it would be obvious that this experiment, they would say, well, of course I can't control a coin or see the future. But they would ask slightly more subtle questions like, would you do better with practice, or would you do worse if you were distracted? And to those two questions, for instance, a significant number said yes. So even though if you ask them intellectually, is it random? Can you guess? Can you see can you foresee the future? They'll say no, of course not. But emotionally, on a deeper level, if you get them off guard to answer how they really feel about it, they do feel they can control it. And there have been, and this sounds really bizarre, but there have been a number of studies in other areas to confirm this result, and it seems to be something that's important to people's psychology. you can control things. You can control things if you can develop some kind of control over them, and if you have some input into the results. Work hard, persist. But you'll do better in life if you also recognize where you can't control things.
Yeah. Well, it's just as now that we're down at the end, if you were going to give some advice to people other than, if you go to Las Vegas, just go to the show and don't go.
No,
to
I mean,
casino.
You go to Las Vegas, you say, I'm going to take $100 and have a good time. And if it comes back as 60 or 10, I won't care. If it comes back as 300, I'm going to quit anyway.
Okay. Well, that's the thing. Quitting while you're ahead, I think that's probably the thing. Well, other than that, as we go along in our daily lives, with this natural impulse to feel that we are somehow in control and that things make sense and that there's much more luck and randomness operating than we maybe would like to admit or like to believe, what do we do with that? I guess I'm back to the idea of how it is that you actually use that. Can you turn all of this into some sort of practical advice, T-shirt size that you can give to people?
Well, I think Watson's quote is a T-shirt quote. If you want to succeed, double your failure rate is a good one. I think, persistence is the, better part of talent or of success. I think don't be arrogant if you win. I think, again, it's good to realize that results don't reflect underlying structure, underlying talent, probabilities, the results that we see in the world. I think those, that those are all lessons that I think are important to keep in mind in whatever you're approaching. But to really, it's something that you, it's not really good on a T-shirt because their stuff is so ingrained in us. I think, you know, if you read the book and you look at the examples and you think about it, then it can change your behavior. Mm-hmm. But I think that the slogans themselves probably have little effect on people.
Yeah. It seems, does in the more creative endeavors, do you think that this is even a more powerful thing to keep in mind? That is when that's even more there's
sure,
more
because,
luck
and you know, creative endeavors are populated with you know either people who are the market, the buyers, there's the critics. And everyone sometimes is the critic, and there's you know the publishers, the buyers, and you're constantly getting your stuff evaluated, and it's very important to just pay no attention. You know, again, I talk about SAT essays, which is an art in itself, and I looked at many studies of kids writing essays, and the grades vary widely. So I looked at books. Diary of Anne Frank was sent to the States for translation, and it was rejected as a some kind of cliched, I don't know, cliched chronicle of petty family bickering of no interest to people. Mm-hmm. You know, George Orwell's Animal Farm was rejected because people don't like animal stories. I mean, if you're John Grisham's first book rejected by, I think, 20 publishers. Even Harry Potter was rejected by 9 publishers. You just can't take people, you know, in those subjective areas, people's opinions, and even though they give them as if they're experts and they know what they're talking about, you know, you just have to keep going and believe in yourself. That's what I would tell creative people. And trust me, I've done a number of such enterprises.
All right. The book we're talking about is The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. It's published by Pantheon by our guest, Leonard Melodinow. His last name spelled Melodinow. He's a physicist by his academic training, has PhD in physics from UC Berkeley, now is teaching at Caltech, has also written for television, has written a number of books, including this one. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks, David. It's been fun.